WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
What were your first impressions when you were approached initially about doing the musical based on Duke Ellington's work?
Well, I liked it very much. Actually, I wasn't approached to it. I went around and sort of sold the idea. And started off with my friend and business associate, Manny Fox. We had a thing together for doing and re-representing some of the tapes of that had been unreleased at that point for the old man. And so I said, how'd you like to be interested in doing a picture? Gradually, the whole idea stemmed from that. Then on the way to doing the picture, we might entice investors more by going to Broadway, doing a Broadway show, and then continuing on into the motion picture area. And I've been a partial salesman as long as I can remember, especially since 1950, when we had Mercer Records and we were our own distributors and everything else. I used to sell records in Harlem door-to-door, 5 and 10 at a time.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Gee, I never knew door-to-door record sales existed.
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, you know, in those days, there wasn't too much storage space, and you couldn't take any chances with what you bought. So you just deliver small things, and those I got mostly on the basis of return in case they didn't have any success with them. Fortunately, we made out and it worked out okay.
I know people who did the opposite, knocking on door-to-door looking for records.
That's great.
But you had to decide what kind of producer you were going to feel comfortable with to get involved in a collaboration with. What made you comfortable about the producers of the show?
Well, first off, it had to be somebody, if they didn't understand Ellington or know him, no, I don't think anybody really ever greatly understood Ellington, but if they didn't know him and have some basic interest in him, you couldn't expect any real venture. Successfully. That is from an authentic viewpoint. Now, for instance, we have Manny, who originally went in and delved into the records in the very past, and as a result, that was the natural. And then Belwin Mills, who is producing some of the sheet music or the songs and has the publishing rights for compositions that happen to be the brokers, the couple of the people that are interested in the show. And as well, another of our backers, aside from being, you know, quite knowledgeable in the business of shows and all, having to sit down and reel off about 6 or 7 numbers immediately on the piano, the only thing they've written. And not necessarily those that are popular, you know. I mean, he could play Satin Doll, sophisticated, but he went back and got some things that, you know, you had to delve into in order to really appreciate it. And I felt with this basic interest in people who were more into Ellington himself, then you had the makings of something that was born of love, and from love you got to get success.
What was your approach to the orchestrations for it? Did you want to find original orchestrations, or have you been rearranging things?
Well, what we've done, in the archives, we still have many things which we've preserved, original manuscripts and Ellington's handwriting and so forth. And so we preserve those. We have a vault in the bank where we keep them. And eventually this will be turned over to some institution for the purpose of keeping Ellington well recorded. And whenever we approached a composition in the show, I would go to our resources and find the original score on that particular tune so that we could be sure that we didn't violate any concept or, you know, give some sort of a different picture other than the one that was available at that particular time. And so when you hear a tune in the show such as the Jubilee Stomp, that's actually Ellington's own creation in the way it was played, to the extent that even the solos are transcribed. And we don't normally practice that because that was never Ellington's intention to really guide the way in which a person had to play the music. He created his thing, and when you went on top of it, he wanted you to do yours. But we felt justified in this instance because we were recreating a picture. And musically, Sophisticated Ladies is sort of a biography in composition of Ellington's life. So we go with the earlier things, weave our way into more progressive things, not necessarily progressive, but as the years progress, and finally get into the greatest part of his life, as is the case with most artists. They dedicate themselves to God, and this is was also Ellington's way. And naturally, we wind up with one of the excerpts from the Sacred Concert.
When, well, he did a lot of writing for soloists in the band, songs designed to showcase their abilities. How did things look on the score? Like, if he was writing something that he knew was really going to be like a Johnny Hodges piece, what would it look like on the score where the solo came in? Would there be any kind of marking or shading or explanation?
There might be something there to indicate what he wanted, but he was quite cryptic. And you had to be around him from time to time. And from the early days when he was in the Cotton Club, many of the great writers used to constantly come up there and listen to him from day to day and actually steal pieces of songs and stuff that they would put into their shows downtown or whatever. So he got to the place where he recognized the composers from downtown. The nights they came up, he wouldn't play anything that was interesting or creative on his part. And nor would he take the chance that someone could lean across his shoulder and discover the way in which he was writing. So he used to have little tricks, you know, and he'd take the saxophones and put them on the wrong line, or he put the wrong key signature in. And we have to know all this. We have, and being able to recreate his work, even though we've got his scores, we have to do it in combination to listening to the original record in order to determine what Ellington was really doing, because he really intended to misguide anyone that had access to his scores. And in fact, when he first went to Hollywood, several of the guys out there looked at his scores and they wanted to know if that was a sketch. Ellington was absolutely miffed because he knew that that was an entire score. He knew he could get everything from that little sheet of paper that he had and it would last at least two or three choruses. And he went on to explain, no, that was the complete work.
So how would he rehearse the musicians? Did he have to decode the score for them?
Well, he would, you know, whoever worked with him would always be close at hand. And for the most part, and particularly earlier part of his career, Juan Tizo was a copyist and the orchestrator. So once he'd give Juan a sheet, and Juan, aside from being astute and understanding, was also very fast. And as a result, he'd be writing something, and he'd pass the sheet off to Juan. By the time the two of them got through, they'd write through the night, and Juan would need about another hour and a half, and he'd finish just after Ellington would. And they'd take the thing and put it right on the stand, regardless of where they were. He scared me to death one time. I brought in the score, and he was in the middle of a radio broadcast, and he just passed it on out, and they played it while they were broadcasting.
For the first time?
Yeah.
And this is also that other people couldn't see it and copy it.
Well, in those days, he didn't care about that. He felt anything I was writing wouldn't be that close to his basic secrets. And I guess one of my greatest compliments one day was the fact that he looked at one of my scores and to determine what I had done and then put the score in his briefcase. So I felt I was getting pretty close to it.
Well, you wrote Things Ain't What They Used to Be.
Yeah.
Can you tell us the circumstances behind the writing of that?
Yeah, it was one of those things where you do something quick and without any thought. Actually, I did it out of fright because I had been out late that night, so-called, hanging out with a bunch and partying all night. And he calls in and he says, caught me in my room about 4 o'clock in the morning. Said, I've been calling you all day. I want a fourth side for our record date tomorrow. And he to keep from suffering, because I don't even could beat you to death with nothing more than a few words and a glance. And I didn't want to suffer that the next day. So I scrambled and got this mess together as quickly as I could with everything I might have heard from anywhere just to make sure it was right. And gave it to him the next day, and that turned out to be Things Ain't. And it's strange how the things you do quickest and with the least amount of thought are most natural, are the ones that hang in there. Mood Indigo was 20 minutes in Duke Ellington's estimation as far as having written a tune is concerned. And I guess at best I might have spent about an hour on Things Ain't.
Well, how'd you give it the title?
It was just one of those things where you went across, according to what you were living and the way it was. We were in the midst of doing Jump for Joy at the time, 41, and Jump for Joy was quite a revolutionary work. I had things in there by title to a few of the words out of Jump for Joy came was something like this: "Don't you grieve, little Eve, all the hounds I do believe have been killed, ain't you thrilled, Jump for Joy." And mine was more or less on the same order. Things ain't what they used to be, meaning that we were getting equality now that we had never seen before.
Do you think people ever attribute too much meaning to titles? Because sometimes you read the wrong thing into it, or you realize that someone added on the title long after they wrote the song.
Sure, I mean, you do that with a word, much less a title. And I was asked about Jumping Pumpkins, and that was really a Ben Webster expression. It simply means that you were so short, if you had to get on the other side of a pumpkin, you had to jump over. But they read things into a lot of the titles, and then sometimes they can't really determine what was the cause of the title. A composition that Strayhorn wrote was called Blue Goose, and the inspiration for that was a box of empty orange crate that had a blue goose on it. People said, well, Strayhorn must have seen the airplane tail, you know. And the imagining of it is different in each person's eyes.
I think probably a lot of radio announcers and maybe some band leaders end up attributing things ain't what they used to be to Duke Ellington when it's your composition.
Well, they did the same thing with A-Train. That's Billy
Strayhorn's,
and also Caravan, which is
Juan Tizo.
Juan Tizo.
Does that bother you when you hear that happen, the wrong attribution?
No, as long as they send the checks to the right address. No problem.
Now, I've heard some stories about band leaders where if like one of the musicians would come in drunk or something, their punishment would be to play a really long solo, which they might be feeling very ill-equipped to do.
Absolutely.
Was Ellington ever like that?
Yeah. In fact, you could tell by the painful look that you see on Sam Woodyard's face that Paul Gonzalez had just showed up drunk. He knew that the old man would immediately go into the fastest tempos that he could find and stay there because Paul was very much an intelligent musician. And the only way he could really catch ball off guard or make him suffer is to make him put him in a position where he didn't feel that he was musically correct or apt. And he'd have to play fast tempos for Paul for a while before he could really work on Paul. And oddly enough, Paul was so astute, he took advantage of this many times. When he didn't feel he was getting enough opportunities to blow, he used to come in and act drunk, make Ellington give him students to play.
Now, would this be during a rehearsal or a performance?
This is a performance.
Yes, yeah, so I've always wondered about this, because if you're a band leader and you're going to really lay it onto one of the soloists by making them play when they're drunk, that might really work for the chemistry between you and the soloist, but what about the audience? How is it going to sound? Because you're also concerned about that.
I think Ellington always felt the audience was it was a matter of coincidence if he pleased them. I mean, he was in it basically for his own entertainment. I have no thought about that. He would have successful stints going, like when he did "Don't Get Around Much Anymore" and "I Let a Song Go Out of My Heart." He had tremendous royalties coming in. And he knew very easily how to continue that wave of writing, you know, just like other writers know that if they continue writing a certain way, that they will continue their success. Not him. All of a sudden, he got tired of hearing that sound. He'd go going off in the left field, and he did something like a Perfume Suite. So the result, all of a sudden, Ellington became a little less popular from a commercial standpoint, but he artistically was satisfied, and he cared less. And this is the way he was. He loved the applause, the adulation of the audience and all that, but he wanted it his way. So up to the very last day of his life, he was absolutely and definitely the artist.
Many of the soloists would solo on the same tunes because the tune was written for them. What were some of the things the musicians did to try to keep a solo or a tune fresh for them? And did any of the soloists fall into playing the solos the same for a long period of time?
Well, it was almost required in the old days. For instance, if they were presenting a new tune, as of the time that you were on the stand playing in a ballroom, you could play anything you wanted to. But once it was recorded, It was the thing in those days to play the same solo that was heard on a record. So that, you know, if Erskine did a thing like Tuxedo Junction or Basie 1 o'clock Jump, the solos that you came and heard when the band appeared was exactly the same as those on the record. And not until, I say, recent times, and by the word recent, I'd say in the last 10, maybe 20 years, did they get to the place where they violated the pattern of recording and going ahead and do what they felt like in personal appearance.
Solos have gotten so much longer. Oh, yeah. I think audiences have become less familiar with the note-for-note.
Well,
structure.
Actually, you know, basically, and this I feel is one inclusive remark about all the musics. In the earlier days, the obligation was to go into the recording studio and recreate the sound of what happened when you heard the orchestra in person. And now the fetish is to recreate for the audience the sound that takes place in the studio.
What would an audition be like for the Ellington Band? Were auditions held, or did he by that time know the instrumentalists and know he wanted them for the band?
Well, most of the new men in the orchestra generally were hired earlier by Sonny Griot or Johnny Hodges or Harry Connick, because they had a pulse of what was happening, who was doing what on the outside. Just like he never really heard Ben Webster himself, but he heard so much talk about him that he invited Ben to come up, and he never really gave Ben an audition. He just told him to sit down, and he was on salary. And in many cases, sometimes we'd have to find someone. For instance, when Cootie left the orchestra, and Ivy, which took place practically simultaneously, it was Cootie, Ivy, Billy Strayhorn, and myself that traveled around Chicago to find the replacements for them. And at that particular time, we found Ray Nance and Betty Roche. And they came in, but there was no particular way in which a person entered the Ellington Orchestra. It was usually coincidence.
How'd you look? You just go around traveling to different bars and clubs?
Yeah. We had, you know, had some tips as to who was where and who to listen to and where to go. And they told us that we'd find Ray Nance at Hughes' place. And also, there was an interesting girl who was singing at White's Emporium in Chicago. And we went there, and all the joints we traveled at night, they stayed more in mind than anyone else.
Would you let them know beforehand that you were out there?
No, and we wouldn't say anything to them, nor for what the purpose was of being there. And then we asked them, would they be interested in joining the orchestra and all that, in which case, you know, they thought about it.
Not for too long, I'd imagine.
Well, yeah, because in those days, the great artists, I mean, they weren't really that impressed. I mean, for instance, take Ray Nance. Ray Nance was a one-man show. We went to see him. He was dancing. He was singing. He played his trumpet, violin, and trombone. And he didn't know whether he wanted to leave that security blanket or not.
Yeah, but he got to do, not the dancing, I guess, but he got to play trumpet and violin and sing.
Sure, but he couldn't tell it. How would he know?
Sure,
you know,
right.
He had a picture of what he had seen Duke Ellington. And don't forget, in each case, these people are new and younger, and they didn't know whether they would be beset into being jaded and not do what their thing was at the present. This is a modern jazz musician's feel.
I always thought that for a musician being in the Ellington Band would be the best steady job that one could conceive of, because, I mean, the Ellington Band was popular for decades and decades.
Yeah, but, you know, to the true artist, can be a pitfall, and I think a lot of guys really worry about that, you know. They worry about being trapped in this mire of security. Of course, everybody has kids. They want to make sure they eat and so forth. But to sit there and play the same tunes over 20 years and to have to go on the same solo can be something that really gets to you. Like some of the musicians nowadays complain about being in Broadway shows because they don't have an opportunity to express themselves, and they want to go home and get on the road or play dances or whatever. And you find that it goes in a sort of like a crescendo that or decrescendo. The job they like least is the most steady job, the Broadway show. They'll take the big band, but they prefer the combo. because now you do have a chance to really exude and play a lot of solos and so forth.
Dellington was always writing so much new material. Wasn't there always new material that the musicians would get to play?
Right, but the only thing is he was inhibited because the audiences, particularly if the audience was close to him, like a dance audience, would always come back and ask for certain things that he did.
Right.
Now, in Europe, he would get panned for just the opposite. If he didn't come there with an absolutely new program, right, every time he'd go back, they'd give him the devil.
Well, this is something you've had to cope with. You've been leading the band for about 6 years, and I'm sure that everybody always requests Set and Dahl. And
well, it's been quite a problem for us because we're expected to do things that even Ellington himself wouldn't have been thrown into. We get a man, he wants to come in, and he wants to hear the original arrangement of Mood Indigo. Now, the arrangement that Ellington played was not the original. He had one that he developed after a certain length of time. And they would ask us for things that the old man hadn't played. I mean, we'd get requests for Ring Them Bells and for tunes that come out of the earlier period, like, and we're playing it now in the show, Echoes of Harlem. And particularly when Cootie travels with us, as he does on special occasions even now, they will come up and ask Cootie to play Echoes of Harlem. Well, the old man had dropped that many years ago. Cootie has a violent dislike to the tune because at the time it got popular, they were doing theaters, and they'd have to play 5 and 6 shows a day. So every show he had to play Echoes of Harlem, and it really drove him nuts. He condescended to play A-Train because that was the latter period, and they were doing concerts. But not only that, we're asked to do things that some buff will come in, and we're playing a dance. And they want us to do something that's a drum solo. And I know that the audience itself does not want this, you know, and we'll be in a country club. And they want something loud and raucous, and we're trying to keep the volume down. So that we've had to expand the book. And actually, at this point, we're carrying twice the amount of music that Ellington carried when he traveled, and we have really each man has 2 cases of music in order to accomplish the expanse of what we may be called upon to do. One day it's a concert, the next day it's a dance, country club dance. The next time it might be a soul dance, and the very next night we might be playing for college, and we have to come up with some funk and also alumni date, which means that the people at the college who have the children going to that date want to hear the tunes that were played at their graduation, which was some 25 years ago.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of people do go to a concert wanting to hear what they already know, what's familiar.
Yeah.
So is there a trick to making something that's not familiar so that people will want to
sure.
hear it? And like it?
Well, what we do, like many times, we have 2 arrangements. We have 2 arrangements on Sophisticated Lady. One is the authentic arrangement, and then another one is a samba, which was dedicated to Duke Ellington at a festival when we were in Brazil. And he liked it so much, we went back and got the arrangement and made it and played it because we know this is something that didn't meet his taste. You take a number like Lucky So-and-So. We play that normally, and we also play it as a rock tune. He himself made a variation of one of his tunes. Creole Love Call is one song that's being done literally. And then he turned around and used it as a underlog for a motion picture, Change of Mind, and he calls it Neo Creole, and that's a rock tune. And we play it, and they say, what would Ellington think about it? I say, he thought about it quite definitely before he wrote it.
Oh, you know what I wanted to ask you about? When I was younger, I always thought that Irving Mills co-composed all of the Duke Ellington music since his name is listed in the credits, and he was the publisher, and I guess he got his name down so he could collect half of the composition royalties as well as the publishing rights.
Sure. It was a commercial trick, and in those days it was quite proper. I mean, the guys would go down Broadway, they'd sell something. It's just like right now, you could either sell some mechanical device, or you can take a royalty deal on. So in most cases, in many cases in those days, somebody would write a lyric, Irvin would buy it, and then contribute it to a song, put his name on it.
Was that was considered fair at the time? Because you could probably get away with it now, but
well, I mean, I don't know how many successful businesses you would call would be fair. But the point is, it was part of the trade, and a lot of people who became great enough to go on their own later had to comply to that when they first started off. Another one of the greats that was in the midst of that same thing would be Fats Waller. I was with him one day. He said, I need a couple of dollars. He went upstairs to one of the publishers and said, I got a brand new tune for you. Sit down and play anything that came to his head. And they say, well, what do you want, Fats? He said, $50. They give him $50. We're going down to the bar. They had a new song.
and they'd copyright it themselves?
Yeah.
What are some of the tunes like that?
Well, I don't know. I never know what which ones came out of what Fats did. They say that many of the tunes, I would rather that the people I know about would remain nameless. A lot of people mention it. It's not right, I don't think. Because there's always a possibility that you're wrong. Pop has been accused of stealing tunes, too. He never really did.
Did he ever say to Irving Mills, well, you've had co-composure credits long enough?
No. What happened was, you may see the names on some sheet music now, but basically Irving is not there any longer. ASCAP and the AGAC, which are two musical organizations, wiped him out. They had it rescinded, and they don't recognize Irving.
Oh, that's interesting.
And he since, of course, has gone on to be a multimillionaire. And as strange as it may seem, he and Duke Ellington remain great friends.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they, right up to 1975, kept in touch with each other, had extensive phone calls.
Well, Mercer Ellington, in the 1950s, you had your own record label called Mercer and recorded a lot of Duke Ellington's music on it. How did you decide when it was time for a record?
Well, basically, I didn't decide. Pop was really the mind that was behind it, and he felt that he should give me something that was mine, much as he did his sister. Tempo Music was a family publishing company, and he gave me Mercer Records. But basically, he decided what he was interested in doing or the people he'd like to hear outside of the orchestra. Always the big contract was with a major recording company until later years when we decided to be our own producers and then sell the record to the majors. But if it was someone around he really liked playing and couldn't get them in the orchestra for some reason or they weren't there, like Willie Smith or Red Rodney at the time, he would have, more or less, instead of having jam session, he'd just call them and have a regular record session and listen to them play. And whoever he felt like I said, his entire endeavor in show business was one of self-enjoyment. He did it to entertain himself. And he'd invite these guys in the studio and listen to them. He did the same thing in Paris. He called up all the Parisian piano players and had them come in for a record date as a tribute to Billy Strayhorn. And they all came around, and that's one of the sessions that lays dormant at this point. I mean, but he did tape all those guys.
A lot of the Ellington recordings are now sitting in the vaults of some of the record companies like RCA.
Well, I have quite a few. I've got about 8 more albums left of unrecorded, unreleased things, rather.
Are you going to be bringing them out?
Yeah, I think so. We have the proper interest, but there's so much stuff on the market now. I just feel that to put them out at this point would, in a sense, make them go unnoticed and, you know, just it would be flooding the situation. I think as we go from time to time in years to come, we'll put one or two out each year.
In Sophisticated Ladies, you were telling me about 10 of the people, the band's about 20 people, and about 10 of them are from your band, and the other 10 are from the city that you're in.
That's true.
And that's because the union stipulates that you have to have a certain number of musicians from the area you're playing in when you're doing something for a Broadway show. You think that's a fair regulation?
Well, I don't like it mainly because of my viewpoint. It depends on where you stand.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, from my aspect, caused me to change the band somewhat from what I've been used to on the road. However, I was able to keep the nucleus, the major part of what I felt constituted the orchestra. But on the other hand, you feel that, and we have the same thing in New York City, that if it's like, why should we have a lot of guys from outside come into our town and take jobs which would be available to us, and particularly in the theater? And I don't think there's any great loss to it because the people who have your reputations and can afford to come in and are able to draw people can come into a town, and they're going to get the job anyhow. I mean, if they're really worth their salt, they will be employed, and whatever the condition to be employed will be, and it won't make any difference. So that, well, it's what it is, it's a transfer regulation. And each union has its own. The United States does it. They only allow a certain number of people to come in from each country because they want to keep a certain standard of living up. So basically it's part of what we have decided to be a democratic form of thought. And in this instance, I don't question it. It's been a rule that's been around for years. I know many cases of people who come in, they come to New York, they sit there for those 6 months, and once the 6 month is over, they just ascend and get into tremendous positions. And the guys that have been there all the time are still where they were because there's that difference in the talent. So as they say, the greatest great talent will find its way out of the smallest of towns and find a way to success.
What's it like for you doing a Broadway show now compared to the concert dates that you're more used to doing?
Well, again, even as a leader, I feel the same thing a little that some of the men feel, a little stilted because I can't take my form of thought and inject it into the show each night and change around according to the way I feel it should be. But you also have to appreciate the fact that you are now approaching another level, another plane. You're reaching people that you haven't reached before, which only tends to give us a little more popularity. And it's going to give us a strength, an additional strength, that we haven't had before having this opportunity. Plus, we also have one of the things being achieved that I'm always after, and that's presenting the many sides of Duke Ellington.
Well, the band sounds really good, and I wish you good luck with the show, and I want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's a real pleasure, Terry, and enjoyment.